All right, well, we're still in 1 Samuel. We're going to be in chapters 13 and 14 today. I got a daughter here. I think she's back there helping Carol, though. When my girls were young, I used to tell them, you may lie and get away with it for a while, and people can fool you for a long time, but I promise you, there will be a day when the truth will come out. As sure as the sun rises, it always, always, always comes out. And at this point in our study of 1 Samuel, Saul has been on the job as king for about 2 years, and right about here is what we're starting to see the true Saul come out. His true colors are beginning to show. And we're going to find out that he is jealous, he's petty, he's self-centered, he's got no business in a place of leadership. He looks the part, but he can't do the part. And he's just not a leader. Now, we're going to focus mainly on chapter 14 today, but we're going to look at chapter 13 as well. So that's where I'm going to start, at verse 1 of chapter 13. 1 Samuel 13. Saul was 30 years old when he became king and reigned over Israel 42 years. Now, I don't know what kind of translation you may be looking at this morning. Some of you that have study Bibles may have this verse referenced here. This is a problem verse for scholars. The Hebrew Bible literally reads, "and when Saul was blank years old." It omits the age for some reason. I don't know why, but the years were omitted in the Greek manuscripts too. Most modern English translations use the age 30. That was a kind of a typical age that you might become a king if that was what you were going to do. And then as far as reigning for 42 years, that comes from something Paul, who used to be named Saul, mentions over in Acts chapter 13, 21. The King James, it's just the problem verse. King James, New King James, it dances around it too. They read that Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years. I only point this out. It's not a doctrinal thing. It's got nothing to do with doctrine. I just point it out because some of you may have a study Bible that makes reference to it. It's not a big deal. Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel. 2,000 were with him at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. The rest of the men he sent back home to their homes. Now, we know from last week, he had amassed an army of about 300,000 people, and when they fought the Philistines at Jabesh-Gilead, well, he furloughs, sends home all but 3,000 of them. And he keeps those 3,000 with him and Jonathan, it says. Who is Jonathan? His son. But at this, we don't find that out for a few more verses. At this point right here, the writer just sort of plops Jonathan right down in Scripture and doesn't tell us who he is. But he'll explain it. You're right, it is. It's his son. We'll find out later on. And I got to tell you something. I love Jonathan. He is awesome. He is one of the most underrated Bible heroes in the Old Testament, I think. He's really, really overlooked. When I get to heaven, I'm looking this cat up. And most of what you hear about Jonathan is in his connection with David, his friendship. But we're going to see in these next couple of chapters, he is awesome and brave and a fantastic soldier in his own right. In fact, Jonathan right here is acting more like a king than his daddy. Like I said, he's vastly overlooked. Look, verse 3. Jonathan attacked the Philistines' outpost at Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. Then Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, "Let the Hebrews hear." So all Israel heard the news. Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become obnoxious to the Philistines. And the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. Now we got another battle, another skirmish with the Philistines here. Notice anything wrong here? What we just read? That's exactly right. Saul ain't got anything to do with it. Who did the attacking? Jonathan did. Who blew the trumpet? Saul did. Who took all the credit? Yeah. See what I'm talking about? He didn't do anything, but he dang Skippy is going to take the credit for it right here. That's why I say his true colors are starting to come out. He won't even give credit to his own son. Now, a lot of men in this world would rather give credit to their son, but not this guy. With each passing verse, cracks in his character get clearer and clearer. Look at verse 5. The Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sands on the seashore. This is quite a bit. This is a big army. They went up and camped at Michmash east of Beth Aven. When the Israelites saw their situation was critical and that their army was hard pressed, they hid in caves and thickets among the rocks and in pits and cisterns. So the fight's on. Jonathan's done turned over a beehive and it's getting hot. And the Israelites are scared. They're outgunned. They're outnumbered. I think I mentioned to you before, the Philistines had a big military advantage over everybody in this region because only they had mastered the art of forging iron. So their weapons were far superior to everybody else's. This would be like the United States being the only country in the world that had tanks. You know what I'm saying? It was a big deal. The Jews are terrified. But it's so ironic. You know, they just kept saying, they've always had trouble with the Philistines, but boy, if we just had a king, all of our problems would be over. Now they got a king, and they got the same old problems they've always have had, don't they? We're not like that, are we? In what ways do we act like this? What are some examples of the things we do that make us just like this? Oh, come on. If I could just drive that Mercedes, all my problems would be over, you know? Or if I could just live in this house in that neighborhood, my life would be so much better. Or if I could just not have the wife or the husband I got now and have it with the person that I want to have an affair with or thinking about having an affair with, all my problems would be over. Don't we do that? If I could just win the lottery, that's another one. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Some of the Hebrews even crossed the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops that were with him were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So evidently Samuel had told Saul, I'm coming to you in 7 days, we'll do the sacrifice, and then after I do, you can get it on with the Philistines, but until I do, you just hang tight. Now I know, that's assumed here. There is another place earlier in chapter 2 or something where Samuel says that, but I think this is a different incident. But Samuel didn't show up like he said he would, so members of Saul's army are beginning to go AWOL on him. Look at verse 9. So he, talking about Saul here, he said, bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings, and Saul offered up the burnt offering. Now on the surface, this looks like a classic, I had no other choice. Somebody had to take charge. But this is a big, big mistake. Saul's a king. He's not the priest. There's another king that will try this. Oh, Craig and I were talking about this over in 2 Chronicles 26. King Uzziah. He tried to pull this off too and do the sacrifice like the priest. And God struck him with leprosy. And look at these next verses. This is the way it always works, does it not, when you run out of patience and take things into your own hands. You know, somebody once said, the brave man is not braver than any other. He's just braver for 10 minutes longer. There's a lot of truth in that if you think about it. Look at verse 10. Just as he finished making the offering, Samuel arrived. And Saul went out to greet him. What have you done, Samuel? Asked Samuel. Saul replied, when I saw that the men were scattering and that you did not come at the set time and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash, I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering. He's so busted here. But who's he blaming? He's blaming everybody but himself. And he's blaming Samuel. Samuel, it's your fault because you didn't get here in time. Army, it's your fault because they're all deserting me. You know, and he just had to force himself to do this sacrifice. My translation says I felt compelled. Yours may say I forced myself to do this sacrifice. You know, it's interesting. He had to force himself to do the sacrifice, but I guess he couldn't force himself to pray and ask for God's guidance on this whole thing. So what's so wrong with Saul doing this sacrifice? What's so bad about it? A Levite, yeah. Yeah, he wasn't a priest like we said. He wasn't a Levite. He didn't pray at all. That's exactly, we have no record of it. But he's not doing this sacrifice as an act of worship either. This is superstition right here is what he's doing. Isn't it? I mean, he's not trying to worship the Lord. He's just checking off this box so God will bless him and take care of him. Are you and I any different when we come to church? Not because we want to worship Jesus, but we need a big favor from him this week because we've got a big business deal working or whatever we may have going on in our life. We're no different, are we? Is that too harsh? It's the truth. You notice not one time did he say, did I do something wrong? Or did he never did try to say it wasn't wrong. He knew it was wrong. He knew what he was doing wrong. Verse 13, you have done a foolish thing, Samuel said. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established, pay attention to this. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler of his people because you have not kept the command, the Lord's command. I'll get it out in a minute. Now think about what he just said right there. If you had done right, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. Hundreds of years before this, it had been prophesied that the king would come from the tribe of Judah. Where's Saul from? He's from Benjamin. So how could all that be true? If Saul had done right, how could his kingdom have lasted forever if it's already prophesied that it was going to be somebody from Judah? Yeah. But did he cause him to do it? And see, we get hung up on that. We get into the whole dreaded, dare I say the word, predestination thing. God's foreknowledge does not mean cause to happen. Okay? But yeah, I think God knew it. God is omniscient. This is a kind of a head-scratcher, though. But the one thing, another answer could, they could have served he and David as co-regents. In fact, you'll find out when we get to chapter 23 down at verse 16, that's one of the things that's exactly what they came up with about them ruling together. You know, the Messiah could have come through the David's side of it, and then Saul's side of the family, Jonathan, they could have served along with him. I don't know. But anyway, God would have worked it out. But look at verse 14. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him ruler. In other words, it's a done deal. Samuel has no idea who it is at this point, but evidently God has already picked his man. A man after God's own heart. What is a man after God's own heart? Or a woman? Does that mean you're sinless? What does it mean in your words? A person that's really trying to please the Lord and be in His will. Yeah. Yeah. Saul. Absolutely in love with God. Oh, I like that. That's good. I like that. You know, Saul committed sins against God. David committed sins against God. But David was a man after God's own heart and Saul wasn't. It's almost easier to describe what a man after God's own heart is not like than what he is like, if that makes any sense. A man after God's own heart honors the Lord in everything he does. Saul was always taking credit for all the victories, was he not? Saul was more concerned about his will than God's will. And while all sin is disregard for God, David sinned more out of weakness. And Saul all sinned more out of just blatant disregard for God. That makes sense. Saul never appeared to be truly repentant. But you're right. David's heart was broken. that over what he had done to God. That's exactly right. Are there believers like Saul? I mean, you know, are there believers who follow? You know, Saul was just he wasn't after God's will. As I said, he's after his own will. Are there people inside the church like that? Sure there are. Isn't that what the whole prosperity gospel thing's all about? Let me tell you something. Joel Osteen is not trying to teach you how to glorify God. He's trying to teach you how to give God a little honor to help you achieve your goals. Big difference. Big difference. I think it's a new book he's got out. It's your time to activate your faith, achieve your dreams, and increase God's favor. That's one of his new books. I count your in that title twice. I only see God once. Yeah. You tell me how I can increase God's favor on me. God died. He died for me. Jesus will never love you any more than he does right now, and he'll never love you any less. This currying favor with God, that's straight from the pit of hell as far as I'm concerned. Let's jump on over to chapter 14. This is a big chapter, got a lot of stuff in it. One of my favorite Bible stories, one of my favorite stories in all the Bibles right here. I love this. Jonathan picks a fight. I love this. Look at verse 1. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was standing on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. Make note of that. You know, notice where he is and what he's doing compared to what his son's doing. He's sitting under a tree. With him were about 600 men. Among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. He was a son of Ichabod's brother Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. Now, why is that significant? Why would God take the time to lay out who Saul's with right here? Ahijah, son of Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas. Why would he do that? Who was Phinehas? Anybody remember? He was one of Eli's sons. That's exactly right. Eli the priest, we learned that in chapter 1. And what do we know about Eli's sons? Yeah. They were extorting money. They were sleeping with women that came to, as we would say, came to church. These are people of very low character. He was hanging out with the wrong crowd. And I noticed they're still in the preaching business, this family. That's interesting. But I think the big point is, like just what Mel said, God's pointing out that he's hanging out with the wrong crowd here. Continuing there in verse 3. No one was aware that Jonathan had left. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez and the other Sinna. One cliff stood to the north of Michmash, the other to the south toward Geba. I'm not sure how you say that. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let us go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised men. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." This is an awesome story here. You got these two men, Jonathan and his young armor bearer, and they're going up against, I have no idea how many people. This is a Philistine outpost. And I can just picture this scene in my mind. Philistine army's over there. Israel army's over here. Nobody's fighting. It's just everything's at a standstill. Jonathan gets bored and says, "Let's go pick a fight. Let's go see what we can get stirred up." Who does this remind you of? Who else in the scripture does this sound like something they would do? It sounds like David, doesn't it? When we get into 2 Samuel, all the battle, it seems just like, it's no wonder these two guys ended up best buddies, because to me they're just like each other. And look what he says there: "Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." How did Jonathan know this? He did trust God. That's exactly right. But it wasn't just trusting God. Jonathan knew his Bible. Leviticus 26:7-8. Listen to this. "You will pursue your enemies, and they will fall by the sword before you. 5 of you will chase 100, 100 of you will chase 10,000, and your enemies will fall by the sword before you. So he knew this from reading Scripture too, but see the spiritual analogy that can be drawn from this. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. I'm sure there's a lot of people. There were a lot. Mel. 26, 7, and 8. That's a great verse. I'm sure there were a lot of people in Israel at this time who theologically believed that God could save by many or by few, that nothing could hinder the Lord. But few believed it enough to step out and do something about it and pick a fight with the enemy. Are we like that in the church today? Are we big on theological belief, intellectual belief, and short on stepping out in faith? I got to tell you, as I was preparing this, I couldn't think of anybody else but Brother Shep in that boat. Can I just make a confession to you? I know as well as y'all do, God can pick this building up and float it on the water down there if He wanted to. We all get that. But when Brother Shep started talking to me about the General Jackson coming here during the last quarter of the year, this is their busiest time of the year. They're booked with parties from here to December 31. And I didn't want to throw water on his parade, but I wrote it up here for the prayer request. What a witness that has been to me. His faith is unbelievable. That's what this reminded me of as I was preparing this. God's always on the lookout, not just for people who say, "Yeah, Lord, I believe in You're a holy God and I believe in Your power." He's looking for people that will step out in faith and make something of it, not just talk about it. If all you and I ever do is sit in here every week, and yeah, we believe in God, oh, we believe God's real, He's got power, and we never get outside of these walls and display it, what good have we done? What good have we done? Jonathan proved his faith by his works, just as if he had read it out of the book of James. You know, that's exactly what he does. And look at his armor bearer. He ain't no slouch either. He didn't come up and say, "Boss, you've lost your mind. What are you thinking here?" He just says, "Hey, let's get it on. You lead. I'll follow you." Look at what he says there in verse 7. "Do all that you have in mind," this is his armor bearer said. "Go ahead. I'm with you heart and soul." Jonathan said, "Come on. Come on then. We'll cross over toward them and let them see us." Now watch what he does here. "If they say to us, 'Wait there until we come to you,' we will say, we will stay where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come on, come up to us,' we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands." So he decides, he says, if they see us coming and they look down and say, "You guys stay right there, we're coming down there after you," that's the sign we're not going to attack. God's not in this thing. But if they, if we look up, they see us and they tell us, "Y'all come up here and get you some," then that's our sign. It's time to go. That's the green light. So is he testing God here, making up these? Some people would call this, you're exactly right, I believe, you're exactly right. Some people would call this putting out a fleece. What do we mean by that? What's putting out a fleece? Oh, come on. Gideon did this, remember? He put a fleece out. "God, if it's wet, I'll know you're in it. And God, if it's dry, I'll know you." Remember all that? It's just metaphorically, that's what he's talking about. I think Barbara's exactly right. He's not testing God here, but he didn't presume that what he thought, this was God's will. He's just trying to confirm it with the Lord. "So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. 'Look,' the Philistines said, 'the Philistines, the Hebrews,'" now keep in mind too, Hebrews, that was a slang, it was a term of a derogatory term back in this day. "The Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in." The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson." So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. I love that. Y'all come up here and teach you a lesson. And Jonathan says, man, it is on like Donkey Kong. Jonathan climbed up, using his hands and feet, and his armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind them. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area of about a half an acre. Side note, you know how they originally determined the size of an acre? You know how they really came up with that measurement? It was how much land two oxen could plow. That's just, that was how that term was. Now it's got specific measurements. So this would have been half that. So this would have been how much land a single oxen could plow. Just a little trivia. Cost you nothing. I digress. I just thought that was interesting. So let's look at this story. This is so cool. You just don't hear much about it. Look at verse 4. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez and the other Sina. This is a true story. There was a brigadier major in the British General Allenby's army. He was sitting in his tent one night by candlelight searching the scriptures because they had been ordered to go take a village from the Turks. They had been ordered to attack a village from the Turks that was on top of this valley. And it was a place called Michmash. And this major, I think his name was Gilbert, he had remembered somewhere, Sunday school or something, he had remembered the name Michmash. So he's in his tent searching scripture trying to find this, and he finally found it right here in 1 Samuel chapter 14. And it talks about these two large cliffs that no one knew was there. So he takes it, takes this passage, and he goes to Allenby, his general, and says, this is in the Bible. Somewhere in here, there are two cliffs, a way to get in here. So they sent scouts, searched it out, sure enough, found the two cliffs, just like is written right here. And instead of deploying a whole brigade, they sent one company through that pass. And the Turks woke up to their surprise the next morning surrounded by the British. So it pays to read your Bible and come to Sunday school. I thought that was a very interesting story. Jonathan had enough faith here enough bravery to put his faith into action. Now watch what God does. You know, a lot of times we sit around waiting for God to do things, and He's waiting on us. You know, and God will do a lot of miracles if we'll just step out and do our part. Look at verse 15. Then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field, and those in the outposts and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. Saul's outlooks at Gibeah and Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. You see, Jonathan, he didn't tell his daddy what he was doing. He just snuck off and went over there and picked this fight. And Saul looks across the valley over there, and he sees the army, the Philistine army, just in tatters. They're going crazy, and he has no idea who's over there whipping them. And watch this next series of verses. All these things that Saul does just proves to you he's no leader at all. Look at verse 17. Then Saul said to the men who were with him, muster the forces and see who has left us. When they did, it was Jonathan and his armor bearer who were not there. Now, if you're the commanding general, and you look across, and the enemy's army is in disarray, who does it matter who's over there? It's time to pounce on them. But he's got to figure, you can figure out the who's and the how's and the what's later. But truth be known, he's probably worried who's going to get the credit for this battle. Saul said to Ahijah, bring the ark of God. At that time, it was with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priest, The tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. In other words, stop this. And again, he's not being religious here by calling Ahijah the high priest. This just looks spiritual. You know, he's probably being superstitious. There was no need to bring the ark. God hadn't called them to bring the ark. Then Saul and all his men assembled and went to the battle. Finally, he gets out from under that tree and goes into battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. You see what Jonathan started? One man stepped out in faith, and all hell has broken loose in the enemy camp. I hope that's what happens with the general, with the Jesus and the General Jackson. I really do. For those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp, went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Evidently, some of the Israelites were so scared they defected and went to the other side. But now they're with Saul, Jonathan, and Saul. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel and moved the battle beyond Beth Aven. Now we're going to see one of the stupidest things Saul ever did. Look at verse 24. Now the Israelites were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be anyone who eats food before the evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. Now doesn't that just sound awe-inspiring for him to say? On the surface it sounds kind of grand, but it's a stupid thing to do. Why is he doing this? Why is he making this declaration here? Do what? Yeah, for getting himself front and center. It sounded good, you know. Sounds like kingly, you know, something the king might say. But I think Dick's exactly right. He's putting the focus back on himself. You know, I've never served a day in my life in the military, and at this age I'm probably not going to. But even I know the troops got to be fed. That's common sense. He's just making crap up to people think he's large and in charge here. Do the troops know who the real leader is? They always know. I mean, I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say, I would imagine hand-to-hand combat is pretty tiring, and you need physical energy. Right when they need to be strong, they're weak and discouraged. Look at verse 25. The entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. When they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out. Yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath, so he reached out the end of his staff with the end of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened. Now I got to tell you, the Bible always amazes me how brilliant it is. And man always amazes me how stupid we are. Here we got this incident over 3,000 years ago. God could have made Jonathan come up on a dead animal that was ready for barbecuing or some kind of vegetable superfood, but he gave him honey. Do you know why he gave him honey? Here we are 3,000 years later, and our brilliant researchers are just now figuring out that honey increases athletic performance. And it is considered a superfood. That will not rot. Yeah. Listen to these researchers. They get paid to do this. Ancient Olympic athletes would eat honey and dried figs to enhance their performance. This has now been verified in modern studies showing that it is superior in maintaining glycogen levels and improving recovery time better than other sweeteners. If they'd have just read their Bible, they'd have known this all. Proverbs 24:13 tells you to eat honey. It says Jonathan ate honey, and what happened? My translation says his eyes brightened. He felt refreshed. People want to tell me the Bible's outdated? The Bible is so far ahead of us, we ain't got any idea. We haven't even caught up to the Bible. Then one of the soldiers told him, "Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be anyone who eats food today.' That is why the men are faint." Jonathan said, "My father has made trouble for the country." Now, in truth, as a soldier, he probably shouldn't have said this, although he's right. Drop down to verse 36 in the interest of time here. Saul said, "Let us go down and pursue the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn, and let us not leave one of them alive." "Do whatever seems best to you," they replied. But the priest said, "Let us inquire of God here." Notice Saul forgot to. He forgot about asking God this time. So Saul asked God, "Shall I go down?" Shall I go down and pursue the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" But God did not answer him that day. Saul therefore said, "Come here, all of you who are leaders of the army, and let us find out what sin has been committed today. As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if the guilt lies with my son Jonathan, he must die." He's just trying to sound so big and bad. But not one of them said a word. Saul then said to all the Israelites, "You stand over there, and I and Jonathan, my son, will stand over here. Do what seems best to you," they replied. Then Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Why have you not answered your servant today? If the fault is in me or my son Jonathan, respond with Urim. But if the men of Israel are at fault, respond with Thummim." Now, these were discerning tools. I don't know how to describe them because I really don't know what they were. They were like dice or something, you know. The priest would keep it in there was a pocket in the breastplate of the priest, the high priest, and he would keep these, and they would sometimes roll them to discern God's will. Anybody else know more about that? I really don't know a lot about them. There's not a lot of stuff out there on them. Anyway, Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot, meaning he rolled snake eyes, I guess. You know what I'm saying? It pointed to them. And the men were cleared. Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and my son Jonathan." And Jonathan was taken. You think Saul knew it was Jonathan all along? A lot of scholars think he did. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." So Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die." Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." He's willing to kill his own son than admit he's wrong. Is it not phenomenal how far people will go before they will admit their sin? Doesn't that just blow your mind? Your son? Your flesh and blood? Wow. But the men said, I love this, but the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die? He who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never. As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. That's kind of the gist of it. There's a few more verses there, but we'll stop right there.